Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, or in London, England, where our speaker is this morning. So, Raim Tovim, a good afternoon. Hope everybody's doing well. A pleasure to welcome everybody. Get a dreidel and a lutkin, relax. So, we have, please go off 5 hours of wonderful learning ahead of us. And, I want to just start by thanking our sponsors of today's program. That is Jack and Marla Samuel and Bob and Sharon Silverstein, who are sponsoring the program in honor and loving memory of Miss Grace Weil, Bracha Kayla Bat Lipman Aryeh, mother and mother-in-law of the Dr. Esther and Heshi Stern. These are all friends of ours here in Toronto, and also Rabbi parents of Rabbi Aryeh and Sarah Weil, devoted wife of Mr. David Weil, and cherished grandmother Safta for many grandchildren and great grandchildren, Yehizik Rav Baruch. We should have good memories, long life, and we should celebrate happy occasions. And it's a pleasure to welcome, to kick off our program this morning. We started last night, but this morning's program, Dr. Lindsay Simmons, who's making her debut on Torah Motion. So a pleasure to have her. She, as you will hear, she lives in England. She's from England. She did her PhD at the London School of Economics on the topic of generating piety, agency in the lives of British Orthodox Jewish women. She's very much engaged in the interfaith work, and that's, of course, going to be her topic this morning. She's the co-chair of the local Jewish Muslim Women's Network, spent years learning at Nishmat and Lindenbaum. So it's a pleasure to welcome her. And with that rather long introduction to kick off the program, Lindsay, it's all yours. Vakasha.
Thank you very much. And in anticipation, Chag Sameach to you all. I am now going to try and share my PowerPoint. Please let me know when it is up and running. Is that working for you?
It is.
Okay, so let's see if we can get that.
Your voice is faint. Can you raise your voice?
Ah, my voice is faint. Okay, thank you for that. Let's try to open these slides. So there. Do you see just one slide, or do you see all the slides?
We see one slide in the middle and all the slides on the side. So when you tip on them, I imagine they'll go in the middle. We see the main slide.
Let's just try to get that better.
It's okay with it in the middle. We see it fine.
Okay, but that's good. Now you just see one, yeah?
Correct.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, that's what we want. I'm just going to check. Okay, beautiful. Okay, so thanks for the introduction. And I will say in advance, I'm going to try and leave some time for questions if there are any. Some of this stuff is obviously quite emotional and sensitive stuff that we're talking about. So I'm very aware of that. And please feel free to make comments and ask questions. I would prefer if we could wait till the end so that I can just get through it. And I'd be very happy to hear anything you have to say. So I'll start by saying that this year has clearly been catastrophic for those living in the Israel and Palestinian territories, and it has been catastrophic for their friends and their family elsewhere. It's been catastrophic for those of different faiths, particularly Jewish and Muslim women, whose friendship has been tested by this conflict. And I would say that this is the time when friendship might be seen to make excessive demands of us. It asks us to reach across what could be perceived as unbridgeable divides. And some friendships have obviously teetered precariously as people took sides and are unable to hear each other's pain and despair. Unable or perhaps unwilling to contemplate the horror of war, personal tragedies that war imposes on all and each of its victims. So for some, the usual effects of friendship, so compassion and kindness and care, fell to the wayside under the pressure of political differences or from the pressures of religious and communal solidarities. And some of these women's interfaith friendships have, of course, not survived. In contradistinction to this, there are those friendships which have not only survived this ongoing conflict, but to some extent have been mobilized by it. And indeed, I think in some cases, these relationships have been a catalyst for the communal, local, national, and even international recognition of the contribution that women's interfaith friendship in particular plays in peace building. So through my research that Rabbi Kelman mentioned, specifically of the lived experience of peace building women of faith in the Israel region, which I spent the last years, few years doing at the LSC as a researcher, I found that their friendships offer a model for me of efficacious peace building across borders. And we're going to think about that in a minute. And that, I believe, is an everyday practice. They are an essential component to generating present and sustaining future peace. And arguably, their models of collaborative and productive alliances, they enable a deep understanding of an other's experience, and they're robust, even through upsurges of conflict, violence, and they are sustainable over the long term. I'm now going to talk a little bit about friendship itself. Anne-Marie Ellethorpe, a theologian, argues that friendship provides an important perspective for considering political relationships both locally and globally. Yet this most important relationship when it comes to politics has not been adequately explored. And some of these quotes you will have on your source sheet. More recently, however, friendship has come to be recognized as one of a person's most valuable relationships, with purchase on political life and the relationship between states and their citizens. Indeed, it has been described as a site and a tool for analysis, both within state as a means to identify the connective tissue between communities, citizens, and the nation, and between states in the realm of international politics. And I want to argue that friendship may be the ideal relationship for personal and political transformation, since it demands a mutual engagement in each other's worlds, as well as the recognition of the foreignness at the core of intimacy. And that is to say that the other is not only required for the practice of friendship, but its most fundamental necessity. So this is borne out by the work of philosopher Paul Waddell, who argues that not only is friendship the crucible of the moral life, but more crucially, that we are not accustomed to think of the moral life as friendship. We're not even accustomed to think about friendship as moral, but maybe we should. And that's the quote on your screen. So I suspect, therefore, that friendship lends itself to the practice of peace building. Firstly, it behoves us to look outward as a moral pursuit to consciously and actively make space for another. And it enables us to confront our own biases and misconceptions in order that we become aware of so many honored practices unjust. And in this way, friends impose moral obligations upon each other. And secondly, friendship demands that we turn inwards, we self-reflect. Through seeing what my friend counts as harm done to her, for example, and seeing how she suffers from it and what she does in response, I can try on, as it were, her interpretive claim and its implications for moral practice. That's a quote from Friedman, which you also have. And in this way, friendships are not necessarily external to the self, but constitutive of the self. And what I think about this is that it's a learned virtue, or it's an ongoing learning process. And this aspect of friendship demands the work of developing one's inwards dispositions. And I think, therefore, it's perhaps described best as a humility of sorts. And these endeavors are intrinsic to the bonds of friendship, and they play a huge role within active peace building. And that's where the notions of otherness or the performance of unlearning are crucial features. And specifically, I want to mention here the active participation that friendship requires. And I think that's important because, like moral performances described above, it means that friendship is a process rather than achievement. And it's this description of friendship that I believe compares well to the notion of a religious life, within which a person commits to determined striving, and the sense that the faithful live lives as a verb rather than a noun. So in order to think about how this is mobilized, now I'm going to turn to the work of the late Emeritus Chief Rabbi, Lord Sacks. And I'm going to look at all his works, his books, his essays, his speeches, his interviews, and they're, you know, copious and eclectic. But I've categorized them into four strands, which you also have at the top of your second page: biblical theology, common humanity, radical listening and radical conversations, and covenantal hope. So obviously, given the brevity of this presentation, I'm going to define each one very concisely, and I'll relate it to acts of peace building between Jewish and Muslim women in the UK since October the 7th, 2023. So let's start with biblical theology. In 2007, Rabbi Sacks gave the Kenan Institute for Ethics Distinguished Lecture, and he described a narrative process developed through the stories of Bereshit, of Genesis, of sibling rivalry, which begin with fratricide and conclude with forgiveness and the building of a nation. And he says the following: from fratricide, Cain and Abel, to reconciliation, Isaac and Ishmael, to friendship, Jacob and Esau, to forgiveness, Joseph and his brothers. And he calls it the progression from conflict to conciliation. So the first, which you also have on your sheets as source 8, is when Cain kills his brother Hevel, Cain kills Abel. Okay, and this is the pasuk, the verse, Vayomer Cain el Hevel achiv, Vayehi b'hayasam b'sadeh v'yakam Cain el Hevel achiv v'yahargahu. And Cain said to his brother Hevel, Abel, and then there's this blank. And when they were in the field, Cain set upon his brother Hevel and killed him. So there's a huge gap here. Vayomer Cain el Hevel achiv. Cain is supposed to say something, but there's nothing said. There's an empty space. And I want to say that they are unable to articulate their difficulties, right? The text leaves this gaping hole where there ought to be some kind of narrative, a word, a question, a complaint, or something. So the question should be, what is the consequence of the silence, right? The inability to have a conversation, to create a relationship. And it seems that the consequence of this, of course, is murder. Okay, the second story, that's source 9 on your sheets, is between Yitzchak, Isaac, and Ishmael. And it follows 12 chapters later in Bereshit in Genesis 16. You should have that. Hagar, Sarah's handmaid, runs away from her harsh treatment after becoming pregnant. And an emissary, a malach of God, appears to her. And I'm just going to read the English for brevity. And God says, Hagar, slave of Sarai, where have you come from? Where are you going? And she says, I'm running away from my mistress Sarai. And an angel of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the Lord, says to her, go back to your mistress and submit to her harsh treatment. And the malach, the angel of God, says, I will greatly increase your offspring, and they shall be too many to count. And the angel of the Lord said further, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you call him Ishmael, for the Lord has paid heed to your suffering. From the word Shema, Yishmael, God has heard your suffering. And again, later, in Chaf Aleph in 21, that's source 10 on your sheet, Hagar is banished again with her son Yishmael, and she's again visited by a malach, an angel. And it says, Vayishma Elokim es kol hanar, God heard the cry of the young boy, again only English, and an angel of God called Hagar and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heeded the cry of the boy where he is. Okay, ki shema Elokim. So we see shema Elokim, that God hears twice. Okay, I'm going to just skip the rest. Please read it for yourselves later. And I want to say that here we see that not only are Hagar and Yishmael visited by a malach, an emissary of God, but they're told that God has heard them twice and taken notice of their pain and their anguish. And here I want to argue, as Rav Sacks argues, that God cares about those who are banished, right? Those who are unchosen, those who are different perhaps from ourselves. And indeed, of course, the text goes far to say later, Vayehi, at the end, Pasuk here, number 20, Vayehi Elokim Eshana, God was with Yishmael. Okay, the third story of sibling rivalry, you've got source 11, where again, the only just younger usurps the spiritual inheritance of the older, and that's the case of the twin brothers Jacob and Esau. And the rupture between the two causes Yaakov, of course, Jacob, to flee, and he's only reunited with his brother 20 years later, and that is in Genesis chapter 33. And there you have that in source 11. Esav ran to greet him. He embraced him. Falling on his neck, he kissed him and they wept. So there's a lot has been said about this encounter. But nevertheless, I think we can argue there is an emotional reunion of salt. And not necessarily, I think, for something specific, but perhaps for reconciliation itself. Okay, and lastly, let's have a look at the story of Yosef, Joseph, and his brothers, which you have in source 12, which is, as I'm sure you all know, a story of jealousy, of hatred, of separation, but also a story of forgiveness and of reunion. So Yosef's brothers return to Egypt a second time because of the famine in Canaan, in Canaan, and they bring their youngest brother, Binyamin, and they request more provisions from Yosef. And this is where Yosef, Joseph, reveals himself to his brothers. And this is, he says, I am Yosef, Od Avinu Chai, is my father still alive? And his brothers could not answer him. V'lo yachlu echav la'anoso so. His brothers couldn't say anything. And this is very interesting because if you compare it with the psukim, with the verses, the verse specifically that I brought you about Cain and Hevel, there's also a space where there's no narrative, where there could be something said and nothing is said. But it says here, ki nivhalu bepanav. They were so amazed, they were so shocked that it was him. And then he says, come forward, and they came forward, and he says, I'm Yosef again, right, who you sold to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. And then he says the following in verse 5, do not be distressed or reproach yourself because you sold me here. It was to save life that God sent me ahead of you. So at first, similarly to the silence of Cain and Hevel, right, Yosef's brothers can't speak, but Yosef persists. Okay, so that's the difference between the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, the book of Genesis, and the end of book of Genesis. Because eventually here, by the end, there is forgiveness. There is reconciliation. There is relationship. And again, there is the beginning of nationhood. So Rabbi Sacks asks the following question about this progression. And he says, why is Genesis, and I quote, not a philosophical text, but rather a set of narratives? Why is Judaism not as system, but as story? End of quote. And then he answers and says the following. Philosophy will not stop us killing other human beings. The immense project the Bible is undertaking is to tell us a set of stories, which we can only achieve through narrative. Why is that? To see the world through someone else's eyes. It is only when we can enter the mind of another that we can save ourselves from inhumanity, and we can no longer deny the humanity of others unlike us. So this is a photo of myself and my very dear friend, Julie Siddiqui. So this is a breakfast television interview, and this was following an interfaith vigil in November 2023, which I'll return to in a moment. And Dr. Julie Siddiqui said the following. She said at this public television interview, why am I made to choose? Don't make me choose. Their pain is pain and my pain is pain. Okay, secondly, I want to talk about common humanity. In 2015, Rabbi Sacks spoke at Rutgers University just after the publication of his book, Not in God's Name, which I'm actually giving a class on next semester, if anyone's interested, at the London School of Jewish Studies. And in that speech, he said the following. The Bible is written the way it is written, not by accident. The Bible does not begin with Judaism. It begins with a statement in Genesis 1, when God says, let us create man in our image according to our likeness. And this applies to every human being, regardless of color, culture, class, or creed. Every one of us is in God's image, which means one who is not in my image is still in God's image. And then he asks the following, and you have this on your screen. Can I see the trace of God in the face of a stranger? And that is the ultimate appeal, that our common humanity precedes and must take priority over our religious differences. End of quote. So, of course, the question is, how do we actually go about achieving this in a world which we don't only believe in common humanity, but we live it? How do we actually go about doing it? And furthermore, I want to mention his commentary on Mishpatim, which is Exodus Chaf Aleph 21, in which the Jewish people, B'nai Yisrael, are told over and over and over and over again to love the stranger. And he says the following, and I quote, "I made you into the world's archetypal strangers so that you would fight for the rights of strangers, for your own and those of others, whoever they are, wherever they are, whatever the color of their skin or the nature of their culture, because though they are not in your image, says God, they are nonetheless in mine. There is only one reply strong enough to answer the question, why should I not hate the stranger? Because the stranger is me," end of quote. And I just have to say that Rav Sacks here doesn't say we should learn from our experience in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, as the stranger. He says we were sent their purposes, quite a radical statement. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God sent us there purposely in order that we become these kind of people. So it is a profoundly basic and perhaps arguably very obvious kind of theological strand of thought that every human being is made in the image of God. But he suggests, therefore, we need to care for and pursue justice for every other, right? Others in pain and so on. And that was the impetus for us holding a vigil in November 2023, which was kindly hosted by Westminster Abbey. That is me again and my friend Julie. And at this vigil, and Westminster Abbey is in the background here in London, we were actually given a room there called the Jerusalem Chamber, very kindly, by a woman who's now just been ordained as a bishop, actually, in York, which itself is very interesting Jewish history-wise. Anyway, we held this vigil for over 50 women, and they were all invited anonymously at the time because it was just very close. It was November. It was a month later from October the 7th, and lots of communities and people who were heading communities and people in prominent positions had a lot of people that they needed to keep relationships with. So we asked well-known media personalities, grassroots activists, academics, faith leaders, heads of local and national community organizations, and also journalists. And they came together to participate in this safe, sacred and peaceful space to listen, contemplate, support and comfort all those in pain. But especially, and I want to emphasize this, to feel that they could indeed come together, right? That there was some camaraderie amidst the catastrophic events of October and following. And I want to mention here that the room was booked for an hour, but none of the women wanted to leave. We were eventually, and very kindly, thrown out. But I want to say that the women who attended this event experienced this idea of common humanity that had, I would say, been lost, abandoned, forgotten, and they didn't want to leave it behind. They wanted to stay. Okay, thirdly, radical listening and radical conversations. In Judaism's Life-Changing Ideas, a weekly reading of the Jewish Bible, Rabbi Sacks wrote an essay on Exodus, on Shemos, and he says, it was called God Loves Those Who Argue. And he said the following, and I quote, "I have become increasingly concerned about the assault on free speech taking place throughout the West." Remember, he said this, okay, many years ago. So it's quite interesting how pertinent I feel it is at the moment, particularly in university campuses. This is his words again. "This is being done in the name of safe space. That is a space in which you're protected against hearing views which might cause you distress, trigger warnings, microaggressions. Undoubtedly," he continues, "this entire movement was undertaken for the highest of motives, to protect the feelings of the vulnerable. And that is a legitimate ethical concern." But then he goes on to say the following: "A safe space," and you have this on your screen, "is not one in which you silence dissenting views. To the contrary, it is one in which you give a respectful hearing to views opposed to your own, knowing that your views too will be listened to respectfully." And then he continues and suggests that the pursuit of truth and justice requires the freedom to disagree. What we need, therefore, is not safe spaces, but rather civility, end of quote. So my question is, how do you pursue this civility? And in his TED talk in 2017, I think that Rav Sacks answered the question, and this is what he said: "We need to renew those face-to-face encounters with the people not like us." Okay, so just a couple of months ago, we held an event which was hosted in something called the Makam Center, an Arabic word makam, very similar to the Hebrew word makom, the space, which is in a suburb called Queen's Park, which is a suburb of London, which is populated by many immigrant communities, actually, lots of Jews and lots of Muslims, Muslim communities there. And ordinarily, I have to say, they do not spend that much time together. And they've, of course, been further separated this year. The centre actually was founded by Yusuf Islam, for those of you who know him, formerly known as Cat Stevens. His hope is that this generates like a truly local meeting space. Anyway, the event included formal welcomes from Jewish and Muslim hosts, both women, speeches from local councillors, and they had Muslim and Jewish high school students reading poetry and prayers. And there was also a conversation, which is what you're seeing here, with the BBC's flagship radio news programme, Today anchor, Michal Hussein, who you can see on the left-hand side here. Now, she's actually subsequently left. She left the BBC about a week ago. And she also is a woman who has been questioned about her balance and integrity at the BBC, like everybody else, in journalism, and especially on very popular media. She herself is a Muslim, and she also lives near that area. Anyway, the event was very full. It was really vibrant, and it was very open and honest. And Julie and I were interviewed about the work that we do together, both locally and nationally. And I said the following, and I quote, "Julie and I are friends, not fair weather friends, but friends who are kind and steady and honest in good times and in extraordinarily challenging times. It is precisely during these catastrophic times that we do not avoid each other, but rather we reach out to one another. We do not avoid asking each other or discussing with each other how we feel, how we are coping, the issues that matter. It is precisely during these times that we ensure that we listen to each other, that we comfort each other, and that we make significant space for another voice. It is during the most testing of times that we remain loving and loyal, open and compassionate, argumentative and honest." End of quote. So there was lots of time for food and conversation after the formal part of the evening. And that's often the best opportunity to meet people you don't know, to delve a bit deeper into their lives, to ask some questions, but most importantly, to come face to face and to converse with people not like us, in Rabbi Sacks's own words. Okay, lastly, I'm going to get to covenantal hope. So, in The Dignity of Difference, Rav Sacks spells out his understanding of covenant. And he says the following: covenant is an attempt to create partnership without dominance or submission. Covenant occurs when two individuals or groups, differing perhaps in power, pledge themselves in mutual loyalty to achieve together what neither can achieve alone. And you have this on your screen now. And he said the following too, continuing: what makes covenant the concept for our time is that it affirms the dignity of difference. Also, of course, a name of one of his most famous books. On the 6th of October, 2024, a joint vigil was held in central London. So that's the day before many separate commemorations were held by a variety of communities in the UK. And in this photo, you can see that they're indeed Muslim and Jewish women, and they are committed to their friendships, and they continue to pursue peace building. And most importantly, I think, this vigil was the first item on the BBC's London Evening News, both at 5 p.m. and at 8 p.m. And I tell you that because I want you to sort of be aware. I mean, I'm from London and you're, I think, mostly in the U.S. And I think just the kind of general communal stroke cultural kind of normative stuff that goes on might not be so familiar to you. So I want you to know that to be on the news at all is fantastic and exciting and well worth the effort that goes in. But it's also to be the first item on the BBC News really felt like there had been some impact, and that these friendships were not something ethereal or theoretical, but they were something mama short, they had substance. Okay. They were materially and viscerally impactful. Okay. And I think it was a significant moment in that regard for these women who believe in, of course, and practice covenantal hope. Okay, I sped through that, so I'm going to give you a conclusion and then I'm going to play the piece from the BBC. In fact, no, I'm going to play the piece from the BBC first. Let's see if we can go there. Oh, it doesn't want to move. One moment. Yeah. I hope this works. Let's have a look. Okay, give me one second. Oh. Can everybody see that or not?
We can see, but we don't hear anything.
You can't hear it.
I think so you've got to do something. I don't know that I'm not tech advanced enough, but okay, I think there's some system you got to put on before you can play it.
I'm going to stop that sharing and I'm going to see if I can share this. One second. Don't know. Give me a moment, everybody. We have a moment, so I'm not going to feel too stressed. Gate that. Okay. Okay.
You have to click on share audio and share video. You have to click on
both. Thank you. But first, I have to click on that. Options, share sound. Thank you for that. Share. Okay, you let me know if this is... don't think it's going to work. I'm going to try one more time. Okay, let's see if this works. Do you have sound?
Yes.
Welcome to BBC London with me, Alison Earle. Faith leaders from Jewish and Muslim communities across London have gathered ahead of the first anniversary of the October 7th attacks and the start of the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. The event at a church in Waterloo was organised by women, some of whom have lost loved ones over the past 12 months. Jessica Ure went to meet them.
This idea that you can't grieve, I can't grieve for her and her son, and I have to stay in this camp, you know, just doesn't do it for me.
At this interfaith meeting of Jewish and Muslim women, a candle is lit to mark the end of one of the darkest years they have known. They have come together here in the capital, all affected by events in the Middle East, and all united in their hope for peace. Friends and founders of a Jewish Muslim network, Julia and Laura, organised today's event, a rare opportunity and a safe space for conversation.
War travels, so it's had a massive impact on lots of us here. And I just feel that we needed to find a way to bring people together and cut through what will otherwise be continued binary, this space or this space. And this, for me, felt really important today.
Getting to know people as people, as opposed to the other, or as opposed to Muslims or Jews or whatever it happens to be, is completely different. It breaks down the prejudices we have.
It was also the chance to reflect on tensions felt here in the capital.
Young people are so fed up of the world we're living in, and kind of they want to see change. They don't want to have all this hate. There's so much division at the moment, especially on campuses, and no one wants that.
We've had a lack of safe spaces in being able to talk about peace effectively during the course of this last year, because the discourse around having conversations on this has been increasingly and hugely challenging and hostile.
As thoughts turn to those lost ahead of the anniversary, a glimmer of hope here as communities come together. Jessica Yule, BBC London.
Okay, I'm going to end that. And I'm going to just go back to my screen sharing, I hope. She says with confidence. Okay, let me just see if I can. Here we go. And I'll finish with this. This is the last slide. Okay. If we can get there. That's the one. Oh. All right, leave it. I'm going to leave it there. And I'm just going to say the following. So, first of all, I want to emphasize the work that women of faith choose to do in the sphere of peace building. So rather than, as it were, becoming mired in despondent or overwhelming and painful Jeremiad, they offer a more optimistic paradigm of hope in a profoundly distressing, ongoing, violent conflict. And the creation and curation of peace building spaces and the commitment of women of faith to them, I think not only emphasizes attending to otherness generously as an act of compassion, but also as an act of strategy. Okay, it provides a ripple effect of resilience and also of a different future. And it is, I believe, in Rabbi Sacks's framework of interfaith relations, a theological act. So it's an act of religious integrity. In fact, I might argue that it's an act of religious obligation, an act which brings each of us closer to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to God, and to the ideals of living Jewishly. So I'm going to end with a few minutes to go. And this last picture is when Julie and I, just now in November, were given an honorary doctorate for the work we do. But the reason I'm set, well, first of all, it was very nice to get a doctorate. If I'd have known how easy it was the second time, it would have saved me a lot of work the first time. But I want to share this with you because what I want to think about is the way in which we don't anticipate the stuff we do. Friendship is considered, you know, pink and fluffy and not important and irrelevant. And it's what the women do. You know, this is what the UN do and the politicians in track one and track two do. And that's what the women over there do. And there's something about being considered so naive. And we've spoken about this, and I speak about this often in public, is this concept that the cycle of war is somehow militarily, politically impactful and creates some kind of peaceful future. Whereas if you look at it historically, that is not the case. But the case of friendship is that it does actually provide spaces for very real and very actionable peace building. And that is why I bring you this picture, because it doesn't only impact the personal and the domestic, but it impacts the wider world. And thus, I feel that Rav Sacks's approach to this, his theological approach, is something that firstly drives me, but also influences me to believe that it is an act that impacts, you know, globally. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have about 55 seconds if anybody has a quick question they would like to quickly ask. There are a couple of very short comments in the chat box. Lindsay, if you want to take a quick look. Somebody wants to know if you're connected to Rabbi Dr. Yehuda Stolov, his group in Jerusalem.
I am not, no. Okay. I'm looking at this, the girl from Acher. Ah, okay. Okay. I mean, yeah, interesting. Okay, the question of Palestinian deaths, absolutely, you know, yeah. You know, all the narratives, we can argue forever. So I appreciate that. I understand that. I was quoting. But yes, I appreciate that, of course.
Okay, thank you very much. A pleasure. And okay, you have to light Hanukkah candles probably in about an hour. No, it also gets dark earlier in London, even than in Toronto, no?
But I believe so. Within an hour, yeah. In fact, you can light them about 25 minutes, the earliest.
Yeah. Anyway, okay.
for Samir.
A pleasure. Thank you. Nice to have you. And okay.